Who was this guy, Oswald, anyway? A lot more than a 23-year-old loner, that's for sure. Does it make sense that this Marine radar operator who arrives in Moscow in 1959, offering secrets to the Russians, then comes home married to a colonel's niece, and never gets debriefed by the CIA, let alone charged with a possibly treasonous act? The Warren Commission knew from Texas Attorney General Wagoner Carr and District Attorney Henry Wade that Oswald apparently had FBI informant number 179 and was making a couple $100 a month in wages from the Bureau. Wade's source said that Oswald had a CIA employment number as well. Of course, we can't know for sure which Oswald this was. Let me explain. At the time, the Warren Commission places Oswald on a bus heading to Mexico City to try to get a visa to Cuba. He was also in Dallas with two Latinos at the door of Sylvia Odio. Later on, as the assassination date approaches, he's supposedly target practicing at firing ranges, driving a car like a maniac, except he doesn't know how to drive or have a license. Well, how could Oswald be in two places at once? Maybe there were two men, and one of them was setting up the other as the fellow who'd take the rap for the assassination. This question of double identity has been around since 1967, when Richard Popkin published a little book called The Second Oswald. A decade after that came Michael Edo's bestseller, The Oswald File. His hypothesis was that the Marine Oswald went to the USSR, but a different Oswald came back, actually a Russian spy, who then killed the president. In 2003 came John Armstrong's exhaustively researched Harvey and Lee, where the premise is that two males who looked very much alike were groomed from an early age as part of a CIA operation. Here's what Armstrong concluded what was going on. In the early 1950s, an intelligence operation was underway that involved two teenage boys, Lee Oswald from Fort Worth, and a Russian-speaking boy named Harvey Oswald from New York. Beginning in 1952, the boys lived parallel but separate lives, often in the same city. The ultimate goal was to switch their identities and send Harvey Oswald into Russia, which is exactly what happened 7 years later. Armstrong's evidence is impressive, including contradictions in Oswald's school records between the Warren Commission and the New York courts. A Lee Oswald in New York, simultaneously with a Harvey Oswald in Stanley, North Dakota. An Oswald employed at the Pfisterer Dental Lab in New Orleans, while another was in the Marines in Japan. How else do you explain the FBI swooping down on Dallas's Stripling Junior High the day of the assassination and seizing all Oswald's school records, as assistant principal Frank Cudlatty remembered, during years when he was officially attending a different school? The way Armstrong pieced it together, when Harvey went to Russia, Lee stayed in New Orleans and Florida, associating with Cuban exiles and their CIA handlers. And as the fateful day approached in Dallas, Lee was used to impersonate Harvey in a series of events aimed at setting up Harvey as the assassin and falsely implicating Cuba as being behind the whole thing. I realize this sounds like something out of the most bizarre sci-fi novel, but there's quite a bit already in the existing record that supports such a possibility. It turns out the Warren Commission never saw a memorandum that Hoover sent to the State Department 9 months after Oswald's defection, dated June 3, 1960. Hoover wrote that there is a possibility that an imposter is using Oswald's birth certificate. After this memo surfaced when a researcher stumbled across it in the National Archives in 1975, Warren Commission investigator W. David Slauson was asked about it by the New York Times. Slauson said, "I don't know where the imposter notion would have led us, perhaps nowhere, like a lot of other leads." But the point is, we didn't know about it. And why not? It conceivably could have been something related to the CIA. I can only speculate now, but a general CIA effort to take out everything that reflected on them may have covered this up. Now think about this. There are almost 50 separate instances of U.S. government files from the CIA, FBI, Secret Service, Military Intelligence, Dallas Police, and Warren Commission testimony where Lee and Harvey are transposed. In quite a few of these, the original file identifying a Harvey Lee Oswald was altered after the assassination to read Lee Harvey Oswald. Which raises the obvious question. Was there an intelligence operation involving one Oswald who identified himself as Lee and another who called himself Harvey? When Oswald's older brother Robert showed up at the Dallas police station not long after he was told about Lee getting arrested, the very first question the FBI posed to him was, "Is your brother's name Lee Harvey Oswald or Harvey Lee Oswald? We have it here as Harvey Lee." Robert replied, "No, it's Lee Harvey Oswald." The first Dallas police memo generated that day also designated the fellow as Harvey Lee Oswald. An Army cable sent from Fort Sam Houston to the U.S. Strike Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida started out, "Following is additional information on Oswald, Harvey Lee." By the time the Secret Service interviewed Oswald's widow, Marina, 3 days after the assassination, you'd think they'd have the name right. But the way they phrased it to Marina went, "After you married Harvey, where did you and Harvey maintain your address or residence?" And the Secret Service report of its interview with William Stout Oswald said he stated that although Harvey Lee Oswald is said to be his second cousin, he had never met him, nor had he known Harvey was also employed by the William B. Riley Coffee Company. This weird pattern had been going on for a long time. When Oswald was living in Russia, a March 2, 1961 memo from the U.S. Passport Office to the State Department Security Office requested that the recipients advise if the FBI is receiving info about Harvey on a continuing basis. Soviet records only deepened the mystery. Oswald was known to sometimes use the name of Alec with people he knew over there. When he was hospitalized in Minsk for an adenoid operation, he's variously listed as Harvey Alec Oswald, Harvey A. Oswald, and H. A. Oswald. The name Lee doesn't appear on any of the hospital files. A CIA document dated 3 days after the assassination says, "It was partly out of curiosity to learn if Oswald's wife would actually accompany him to our country, partly out of interest in Oswald's own experiences in the USSR, that we showed intelligence interest in the Harvey story." I found that phrasing rather odd. Back in Texas on Thanksgiving Day, 1962, Oswald entered his name as Harvey in his half-brother John Pick's address book. This is despite the fact that a guy named J.E. Pitts, who served with him in the Marines, remembered that Oswald had an intense hate for anyone that called him by the nickname Harv or by his middle name of Harvey, and he wanted to fight anyone that did it. Okay, now let's turn to the question of Oswald's height. The Warren Report has Oswald standing 5'9" tall, the height recorded by the Dallas police after his arrest and during the autopsy on his body after Ruby shot him. The commission's 26 volumes of testimony and exhibits have 12 different documents recording that same height. These are all heights for Oswald in the United States after he came back home in 1962. The 5'9" is on all of his employment applications, including the one at the Texas School Book Depository, and also how he was measured by the New Orleans police after getting arrested during a street confrontation with some anti-Castro Cuban exiles on August 9, 1963. It's also the height listed earlier when he finishes his Marine boot camp on December 28, 1956. But what the Warren Report doesn't say is that on documents concerning his discharge from the Marines and his travels overseas after that, he's listed as 5'11", not just once, but three times over 11 days in September 1959, by a doctor and two other Marines. He's 5'11" on his passport when he goes to Russia, and an application he makes to get admitted to Albert Schweitzer College in Switzerland. A total of eight documents in the Warren volumes have an Oswald 2 inches taller than the guy who got arrested on November 22, 1963. When the police checked Oswald's wallet on the afternoon of the assassination, they found both a 1959 Marine Selective Service System registration card and a Department of Defense identification card listing his height as 5'11". In the same wallet was a counterfeit Selective Service System registration card under the fictitious name of Alec James Hedell. Hedell's height was listed as 5'9". It gets stranger. Before he was buried, Oswald's body was unattended when an FBI team came to spend quite a bit of time checking it over carefully and taking another set of prints, according to the Fort Worth Press. When an FBI agent looked up Oswald's early medical history, a mastoidectomy and operation scar were noted on his Marine Corps health records from a procedure he'd undergone at the age of 6. But the postmortem report of November 24, 1963, didn't list any scar or bone removal. Paul Grudy, the funeral director who buried Oswald, recounted a story years later. Secret Service agents, he said, had come to ask him questions about some marks on Oswald's body and told Grudy, "We don't know who we have in that grave." Richard Helms, who was then in charge of clandestine operations for the CIA, sent a memo to the FBI on February 18, 1964. Helms was interested in a scar that Oswald was supposed to have had on his left wrist after he allegedly attempted suicide in Moscow in 1959. Helms requested any FBI information, including the undertakers, copies of any reports, such as autopsy or other, which may contain information pertinent to this point. The best evidence of a scar or scars on the left wrist would, of course, be direct examination by a competent authority, and we recommend that this be done and that a photograph of the inner and outer surfaces of the left wrist be made, if there has been no other evidence acceptable to the Warren Commission that he did, in fact, attempt suicide by cutting his wrist. A week later, two Dallas FBI agents contacted C.J. Price, the administrator at the Parkland Memorial Hospital, where Oswald's autopsy took place. Price said, "He failed to observe any scar on Oswald's wrist, nor did anyone else, as far as he knew." According to a memo by Warren Commission investigator Slauson, March 13, 1964, "The CIA is interested in the scar on Oswald's left wrist. The FBI is reluctant to exhume Oswald's body as requested by the CIA." The new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, contains a fresh interview that brings even more credence to the double Oswald scenario. Author Jim Douglas tracked down a fellow named Warren Butch Burroughs, who was running the concession stand at the Texas Theater where Oswald was apprehended. He says Oswald came in sometime between 1 p.m. and 1:07 p.m., which is several minutes before Oswald supposedly shot and killed policeman J.D. Tippett, seven blocks away. Burroughs sold him popcorn at 1:15, the very moment of Tippett's slaying. Most stunning of all was Burroughs's revelation that a few minutes after the cops came rushing in to surround Oswald and half-drag him out the front of the theater, a second man who looked almost like Oswald, like he was his brother or something, was arrested and taken out the back of the theater. Burroughs wasn't the only witness to this. Bernard Hare, who owned Bernie's Hobby House 2 doors east of the theater, had also seen police bring a young white man dressed in a pullover shirt and slacks out the rear door of the theater, where he was driven off. Told that Oswald had been brought out the front, Hare was bewildered and said, "I don't know who I saw arrested." You've also got witnesses at the book depository building seeing Oswald walk out the front and get driven off in a car, and more witnesses seeing him go out the back and take a bus. There are more witnesses inside the building who claim to have seen Oswald in 2 places at once. So there's quite the possibility that both of them, Lee and Harvey, were in the book depository at the same time. My hunch is that they were both part of a false defector program that James Angleton and his friends in counterintelligence were running out of the CIA. While Harvey was over in Russia, Lee was working with anti-Castro Cubans in Florida, planning to bump off Castro. He was seen by a number of people down there at the same time. Harvey, the wimpy-chinned one in the photographs, was married to Marina. Lee, the thick-necked one, was used to set up Harvey. I believe it's Harvey laying in the grave, and whatever happened to Lee, I have no idea. To me, it's a provable thing. All we need to do is ask the Oswald descendants, the 2 Oswald daughters, to take DNA tests. If they match up with Lee, I'll be the first one to say, well, I guess there was only 1 Oswald then, or at least the one on the ground is the father of the 2 daughters. But right now, I don't think so. In Armstrong's book, there's also the matter of the 2 mothers. Apparently, the real Oswald mother was quite an attractive, tall woman. But then, you've also got short, dumpy Marguerite. What proves to me that she was a fraud? In 1 interview she gave, she had Lee's birthday wrong. I don't know of a woman who's ever given birth to a child that can't remember the day. I can't end this chapter without a few words about the national media's role in the cover-up. The very first dispatch out of Dallas on November 22, 1963, came from the Associated Press. The shots apparently came from a grassy knoll in the area. That was the news in most of the early reports, though it was soon replaced by the Texas School Book Depository. Dan Rather, who was a local newsman in Dallas at the time, was the first journalist to see the 20-second-long home movie taken by dressmaker Abraham Zapruder. Rather then told a national TV audience that the fatal shot drove the president's head violently forward, when the footage showed just the opposite. Later on in his book, The Camera Never Blinks, Rather defended his mistake, saying it was because his watching the film had been so rushed. But nobody could question this at the time, because Time Life snapped up the Zapruder film for $150,000, a small fortune back then, and battled for years to keep it out of the public domain. The Life magazine publisher, C.D. Jackson, was so upset by the head wound sequence, according to Richard Stolle, who was then the magazine's L.A. bureau chief, that he proposed the company obtain all rights to the film and withhold it from public viewing at least until emotions calmed. We didn't find out until 1977, when Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame wrote a piece for Rolling Stone on the CIA and the media, why we should have been upset about C.D. Jackson. Bernstein explained, "For many years, Time Life founder Henry Luce's personal emissary to the CIA was C.D. Jackson, a Time, Inc. vice president who was publisher of Life magazine from 1960 until his death in 1964. While a Time executive, Jackson co-authored a CIA-sponsored study recommending the reorganization of the American intelligence services in the early 1950s. He also approved specific arrangements for providing CIA employees with Time Life cover. Some of these arrangements were made with the knowledge of Luce's wife, Claire Booth. Mrs. Luce was a member of the Committee to Free Cuba, and right after the assassination started putting out information connecting Oswald to Cuba information she received from a group of CIA-backed Cuban exiles that she supported. The CIA still won't release its files about that group. Life published a story headlined, End of Nagging Rumors, The Critical 6 Seconds, December 6, 1963, that claimed to show precisely how Oswald had succeeded in hitting his target. Supposedly based on the Zapruder film, the magazine said that the president had been turning to wave to someone in the crowd when one of Oswald's bullets hit him in the throat. But guess what? That sequence is nowhere to be seen in the film. From the get-go, Oswald was damned as guilty by the media. The headline in the New York Times, Career of Suspect Has Been Bizarre. In the New York Herald Tribune, Left-Wing Lunacy, Not Right, Is Suspect. In Time magazine, Evidence Against Oswald Described as Conclusive. Here's what media critic Jerry Polakoff later had to say. Thus, the press's curiosity was not aroused when a 7.65 caliber German Mauser mutated into a 6.5 caliber Italian Mannlicher Carcano, or when the grassy knoll receded into oblivion, or when an entrance wound in the president's throat became an exit wound, first for a fragment from the head wound and then for a bullet from the back wound, or when a wound 6 inches below the president's shoulder became a wound at the back of the neck. The press was thereby weaving a web that would inevitably commit it to the official findings. 3 months before the Warren Report appeared in September 1964, the New York Times ran a page one exclusive, Panel to Reject Theories of Plot in Kennedy Death. They then printed the whole report as a 48-page supplement and collaborated with Bantam Books and the Book of the Month Club to publish both hardcover and paperback editions. The commission analyzed every issue in exhaustive, almost archaeological detail, according to reporter Anthony Lewis. The Times also put together another book, The Witnesses, which contained highlights from testimony before the Warren Commission. All these were aimed at shoring up the lone gunman notion. In one instance, a witness who reported having seen a man with a rifle on the 6th floor had other portions of his testimony eliminated, namely that he'd actually seen 2 men, but been told to forget it by an FBI agent. Witnesses like Zapruder, who believed some of the shots came from in front, were left out entirely. Life magazine devoted most of its October 2, 1964 issue to the Warren Report, assigning commission member and future president Gerald Ford the job of evaluating it. In 1997, the Assassination Records Review Board would release handwritten notes by Ford, revealing that he had misrepresented the placement of the president's back wound, raising it several inches to suggest he'd instead been struck in the neck, in order to make it fit the theory that a single bullet had hit both Kennedy and Connolly. Otherwise, the entire lone assassin notion would have collapsed. That same issue of Life underwent 2 major revisions after it went on sale. One of the articles was illustrated with 8 frames from the Zapruder film. But frame 323 turned out to contradict the Warren Report's conclusion about the shots all coming from the rear. So the issue was recalled, the plates broken and reset, This was all pre-computer, and frame 313, showing the president's head exploding, became the replacement. A second error forced still another such change. When a Warren Commission critic, Vincent Salandria, asked Life editor Ed Kearns about this 2 years later, Kearns wrote back, "I am at a loss to explain the discrepancies between the three versions of Life which you cite. I've heard of breaking a plate to correct an error. I've never heard of doing it twice for a single issue, much less a single story. Nobody here seems to remember who worked on the early Kennedy story." And so it went. Skeptics of the Warren Report were often labeled leftists or communists. After Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment, and Josiah Thompson's 6 Seconds in Dallas, came out in 1966, questioning the official version, and became bestsellers, the New York Times decided to conduct its own investigation. One of its unit, Houston Bureau Chief Martin Waldron, later said they'd found a lot of unanswered questions that the paper then wouldn't pursue. "I'd be off on a good lead, and then somebody'd call me off and send me out to California on another story or something. We never really detached anyone for this. We weren't really serious." Life magazine also took a fresh look at the case. "Did Oswald act alone? A matter of reasonable doubt." An article in the November 26, 1966 issue was headlined. A re-examination of the Zapruder film, the magazine said, had reached the conclusion that the single bullet theory didn't hold up, and a new investigation was called for. This was to be the first of a series of articles, but in January 1967, editor Richard Billings says he was informed that it is not Life's function to investigate the Kennedy assassination. That was the last time they'd challenged the Warren Commission's findings. Billings resigned from the magazine and took a job with a newspaper in St. Petersburg, Florida. In 1967, led by Dan Rather, CBS News did a 4-part study that again upheld the Warren Report. Warren Commission member John McCloy was the network's behind-the-scenes advisor. Another decade went by before the Bernstein piece in Rolling Stone showed just how strongly these news organizations were all tied to the CIA. By far, the most valuable of these associations, according to CIA officials, have been with the New York Times, CBS, and Time, Inc., Bernstein wrote. Over the years, the CBS network provided cover for CIA employees, including at least one well-known foreign correspondent and several stringers. It supplied outtakes of news film to the CIA. A high-level CIA official with a prodigious memory says that the New York Times provided cover for about 10 CIA operatives between 1950 and 1966. Bernstein's article began by describing how Joseph Alsop, a leading syndicated columnist, had gone to the Philippines in 1953 to cover an election at the CIA's request. It would be Alsop, transcripts of President Johnson's taped telephone conversations later revealed, who first urged LBJ to form the Warren Commission to answer any unresolved doubts about the assassination. Alsop is one of more than 400 American journalists who in the past 25 years have secretly carried out assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency, according to documents on file at CIA headquarters, Bernstein wrote. Journalists provided a full range of clandestine services, from simple intelligence gathering to serving as go-betweens with spies in communist countries. The article went on. James Angleton, who was recently removed as the agency's head of counterintelligence operations, ran a completely independent group of journalist operatives who performed sensitive and frequently dangerous missions. Little is known about this group, for the simple reason that Angleton deliberately kept only the vaguest of files. Among the CIA's most valuable relationships in the 1960s, Bernstein continued, was a Miami news reporter who covered Latin America named Hal Hendricks. He regularly provided information about individuals within Miami's Cuban exile community. He was the conduit through which the CIA passed word to then-Senator Kenneth Keating that the Soviets were putting missiles in Cuba in 1962, and got awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the missile crisis. On the afternoon of the assassination, another reporter, Seth Cantor, has said that Hendricks provided him considerable yet unrevealed information about Oswald's history, including his supposed defection to Russia and his activities with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The setup seems to have been on, and it involved the media. The cover-up still does. After the House Assassinations Committee concluded late in 1978 that the president was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy, the New York Times buried the story. Experts say that second gunman almost certainly shot at Kennedy. On page 37, right alongside the classified ads. Later, a Times editorial said that the committee seemed more interested in inflaming than informing. And whenever there were intimations of conspiracy in the media, the finger pointed elsewhere, like a CBS documentary, The CIA's Secret Army, which strongly hinted that Fidel Castro had ordered Kennedy's murder in retaliation for the attempts on his own life. When Oliver Stone's movie JFK came out in 1991, the strongest attacks came from news outlets and journalists, with the longest records of error and obstruction in defense of the flawed Warren Commission inquiry. Are we surprised? They'll cheerlead for Posner and Bugliosi's books, but I'll bet you a free lunch they're not going to be reviewing this one anytime soon. What should we do now? One lesson we can take away from the tragedy in Dallas is that the federal government shouldn't be allowed to supersede state and local laws when it comes to having an official investigation into events as momentous as a presidential assassination or a terrorist attack. We also need to pay close attention to how our big media stopped doing their job as the eyes and ears of our democracy, refusing to acknowledge that something might be going on beyond a lone nut assassin. The pattern of denial continues, and we the people must demand thorough investigation and honest, unbiased information.